I know I pitched this movie. No, I had no idea anything about it at all. I had seen three very out of context scenes, like just maybe 10 seconds, and was just like, that looks interesting.
And I'll then, be really curious to learn what those ones are, because I've been, I was thinking about that as I was watching the movie. I was like, which bits were the ones that hooked them?
That's the thing. They didn't even hook me. I just, like, they're going to be the most mundane ones where you're just like, why the fuck? Why do you? But then when I saw Jim Henson on this, I was like,
yeah, Jim Henson and Sam Neill, those two things together would have like sold me blind on this. Mm-hmm. I did not know either of them going in. And yeah, when the Jim Henson logo came up, I was like, oh, okay. All right. Let's sit down and see this.
Because
Sam Neill was in the little Amazon thumbnail and that got me excited. And then Christoph Waltz pops up. So.
Oh, the Countess, Miranda Otto. I like her too. I've seen, I can't recall anything she's been in off the top of my head, but.
Lord of the Rings. And then, it was a weird reunion film because the woman with the hair, I mean, we'll get into it, but the woman with the hair that goes crazy was a, Hunt for the Wilder People, actress, cause she's a regular Taika collaborator.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. I find this so fascinating because the director is Australian. And if you, like me, watched all the way to the end of the credits, there's a lot of, like, Australia loves, like, you can pretty much get funding for just about anything from Australia if you're Australian. So there was a lot of Australian money actually in this, but it takes place in London. And then the rest of the money comes from the U.S. But, like, if you even look up on their, like, Wikipedia, it's like, countries that funded this shit, Australia and America. It's like, and yet it takes place in London.
And not even New Zealand, because you have, like, a couple of...
The most famous Kiwi ever, Sam Neill, so...
Well, pseudo-Kiwi, because he's technically... I think he's technically English. He just grew up in New Zealand, so he considers himself a Kiwi.
Isn't that everyone in New Zealand that's not a natural-born New Zealand person?
And pretty much.
They're all just, like, English... adjacent, you know. They're probably like, boo, fuck you. I'm like, hey, I'd love to live there, okay? Well, that's this movie.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Let's Movie. I am Justin Wood, and with me, as always, if not more often than always, is...
Justin, I'm here. Yeah. One day we're just going to go by terrible nicknames of Jesse and Dusty, so everyone's going to be like, ooh,
don't put that out into the atmosphere, man.
I didn't want to, but at the same time, I was like, I have to.
I am grateful that we are not famous enough for that to leave any impact on the people that I know. Like, I'm not going to walk down the street and someone go, hey, it's Jesse and Dusty. I'm like, oh, great. The small blessings of being completely obscure. But what did we watch today, Dustin?
We watched The Portable Door, which is being released over here in the States on MGM Plus as a straight to streaming. But it's also released in Australia under different distribution and produced by not one, not three, but six, not including the Queen's money in Australia, because that counts too. We've got Stan, Sky, MEP Capital, that's lame, Arclight Films International, the Jim Henson Company, aforementioned one, and Storybridge Films, which had a great logo, I won't lie. Just took a lot of people to make this go straight to streaming.
And it's got kind of a hodgepodge of actors that are not necessarily like Titanic stars by any means, but people who recognize, because we got Sam Neill, Christoph Waltz, Miranda Otto, as we've mentioned before. But then there was a handful of other people that when I looked them up, the receptionist actress, she was on that Netflix Dracula by the Sherlock showrunner.
Oh.
And she's done a handful of other things. It's one of those things where she's not someone I will remember by name, but I've seen projects that she's been in before.
Well, I think that's true for our lead, Patrick Gibson, as well. I have never seen Sophie Wilde in anything that I know of. Yeah, there are two leads. You know, I will say, like, we're given, like, a... I don't even know what to call it. It's like a little tease of a scene in which we see a character going into a place, and then something is said. I'm not going to spoil it right away. and a door is closed, and then we're given this like Monsters Inc. fucking opening that just goes on for way too long. Just
it doesn't do enough with because it, it it has this creative like line animation thing that has that Pixar vibe, but then it just kind of repeats itself and it does drag on incessantly.
And like my problem with stuff like that is like, A, I get it. You're doing kind of a throwback to old films. And B, you want to make sure everyone's fucking asses are in the seat present, paying attention to who made the movie. Like, first and foremost, like a very Tarantino thing of like, you're going to watch everything first, motherfuckers, because I know you're not going to wait at the end. But when you go on that long, everyone stops paying attention. And so your goal of having people look at it first is now gone because they don't give a rat's fucking ass of what you're showing them. They're just like, eh.
It's
just
something
listening
that,
to this little song and hoping it ends soon.
It is something that is kind of weird about this movie because it was made for streaming. Like it wasn't made for MGM Plus. It was made for a streaming service that was almost comically obscure enough to make you go like, oh, there's something below MGM Plus when it comes to the streaming services. But like, they do a lot of things that suggest that this movie not only was like expecting a theatrical release, but it really feels like people on some level really cared about this. Like they have, when we'll get into it, it like has a cutesy pre-scene opening text, which I guess is designed for people who want to rewatch this film to have a, to enrich their experience and be like, oh, I understand that joke now because I've seen this movie before. They feels like they wanted to create something that was going to have like a cult longevity in the same way that like other Jim Henson products did. So why this scene, this title sequence goes on so long, it feels inappropriate for its streaming platform, but somebody seemed to really feel like that this movie was deserving of you reading every single one.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just one of those things they committed to it and then you kind of don't know when to just. You're like, oh, okay, just cut it before you get into lighting. And they're just like, eh, but then, you know, my friend, my brother-in-law, he's in the lighting. And they're just like, all right, okay, fucking cut it after lighting then. And they're like, eh, you know, but like, Terry, our buddy, you know? And it's like, all right, fucking just do all of it. I can't make this decision. And then just, it's all in there. And you're like, yep, that was too long. that was too long, sure.
And it doesn't do anything creative with it. It's like a start of something where it's like, okay, this is going to develop. We're going to see a little animations. It's going to preview events from the movie. Like we're watching a Mission Impossible thing and it doesn't do any of that shit.
Yeah. Instead, it was just like, cursive. Okay, that old stapler is showing up a lot. So I know that old stapler going to do something in this movie, I guess.
Oh, does it ever?
Yeah. I mean, like overall, before we like dive into it too hard though, I will say this is, I enjoyed the shit out of this movie. I'm not gonna lie. I really enjoyed this movie. Yeah, it caught me off guard and I enjoyed it. It's not a perfect film, but I think for what it sets out to do and what it accomplishes, it does a really damn good job of it. It gave me nostalgic feels of other movies I watched as a kid. And I was like, wow, that's something that doesn't happen often anymore. That's for sure. So.
Well, that's something that I guess we can tap also before we start. What do you think this film was intended for children?
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
I think it's intended for children the way like Dark Crystal is or Labyrinth is. You know, I lean more towards Labyrinth because that is a movie I have not watched since I was a child and I refuse to watch it since then. I just have what vague memories I have of it because I know it's not going to be the same as an adult watching that movie, but I remember fondly seeing that at a drive-through of all places. That's the one and only time I've seen it, as a drive-through with other kids in a car, and just the overall experience and the terror and the enjoyment and the excitement. And this harkened back to that for me, where it's like, I will, but this one, I'm an adult. I'd probably be fine watching it more than once, and you know, with my kids or whatever.
Yeah.
So be that. But it gave me that type of nostalgic feeling. But what about yourself? Did you enjoy it? Or
I mean, I think we'll get into it. I will say your enjoyment of the film I find surprising.
Really?
We'll cover that, and that's coming from someone who is also nostalgic for classic Jim Henson production movies and projects, because I still watch Labyrinth. I think that movie holds up exceptionally well. And the great thing about those ones like Dark Crystal and Labyrinth is they speak of a era of craft, which largely feels lost in filmmaking. I mean, we still have craft. We still have an enormous amount of craft that goes into movies, but not a lot of movies put right up front and center that love of craft. The only time I feel stuff like that is when I watch like Wes Anderson animated movies. Like Isle of Dogs is not a movie that I was like as over the moon for as it was a lot of other Wes Anderson, but just looking at the amount of detail and knowing like artisans whose whole thing is like, you know, making tiny models or something like Coraline. Stop motion films are only the only place really where you get that real love of craft being displayed as the main subject on screen. Now, Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio being a recent example. But that, I love that shit. I didn't feel that much of it with this movie. So I didn't same kind of nostalgic vibe. I kept waiting for like a really great Jim Henson puppet to come up, like a really good big size thing. And then when we do get a reveal of the central monster of the movie, I was like, oh, that's a lot less than I was expecting.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is like they're fifth on this list of six. So I knew that. And with just them selling off so many things to Disney, like just the charm is not there as much. And it's like I just am happy there's bits of them still around. But, you know, I know that there's never going to be a full-fledged, like, we're the boss type production. It's always going to be like, well, we have this stuff. Will you use it type of thing? And I feel like, if anything, they were just kind of included in this one for what little bit they did.
Yeah. Though it did feel like it should have been, like, a set piece thing. There's a scene later, which we'll cover when we get into the movie, that does have, like, oh, okay. This is the scene like, the creature effects guys were, like, having fun coming up with a bunch of stuff. Yeah. But I guess we should probably actually get into the movie so we can get to all these juicy bits.
So the story, you know, technically begins with Paul Carpenter waking up late for work. Not late for work. He's late for an interview. He's rushing to get ready and nothing is going right for this man. There's a stain on his pants that you're just like, what the fuck? Did you spill soup on there? Like, what's going on here? His magical toaster, which I was just like, what the fuck toaster is that? Why do you put the bread in and close the sides? What is going on here? What is
that?
Why
do we not have these? That's a Jim Henson creation for sure.
I was like, we need these. It sold me on that toaster. I was just like, what the fuck? Like, I paused the movie, Justin, and was just like, what the fuck? How do I get that toaster? Is that normal? Is that in England all the time? What's happening?
It's a very Bioshock-looking ass toaster.
It was amazing. It was the best toaster I've ever seen in a movie.
Even though it burns the toast. Like, your first example of it working is badly.
I mean, I knew where this day was going with the stain on the pants. So I was like, there's no way that toast is coming out unscathed. Yeah. He keeps breaking shoelaces. He keeps somehow redoing the shoelaces. I don't know. I was just like, what the fuck?
The second broken shoelace was admittedly a pretty funny thing, just because you do it once.
The first one was like, whatever.
Yeah.
Second one was like, there we go.
There you go.
And then he hits the bus, he gets off the bus, he steps in some unspeakable green goo and, just strangely just lifts his leg as slowly as possible, connecting his foot to the ground as long as, you know, but I knew where this opening was going though.
Oh yeah.
All the bad luck and all the, you know, like ironically, this fits kind of well with Bullet Train and the whole coincidence and bad luck and all that shit. Everything is connected to this moment of where it's leading him, to the point where he shows up to this cafe to apply for the job.
There's the longest line for apparently they supposed to be there for, were they all supposed to be there for a fucking coffee hole job? Yeah. Because that's a weird choice. Is it that bad post-Brexit in England right now?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeesh. I mean, if you want to live in London, yeah. Yeah, and then someone stops him and is like, oh, I remember you from school. I taught you and so-and-so. And he's got, like, a bunch of jumbled facts. It's just, Paul's just like, dude, what? Who the fuck are you? I don't, like, none of these details match up at all. Like, I have no idea what you're talking about, you strange little man. And then the line's twice as long. And then the dog steals a scarf, and he's like, fuck this job. I need that goddamn scarf. So he chases this dog, a Jack Russell Terrier, I believe. The dog, of course, leads him to a new place to interview, where he just sees applicants on the door, and he's just like, all right, okay, let's do this. Like, I'm looking for a job. This is applicants. Let me go see what's going on.
It's literally an alley. He's literally going down a dark alley that is filmed ominously, and he sees a door and is like, well, this is as good as Coffee Hole. So,
yeah.
And by the way, this entire time he has been passing advertisements on the bus and the various places for a company, and the slogan is, there's no such thing as coincidence. Right. Yeah. Which keeps showing up over and over again, like this is the only company advertising at all in London, which later on, considering the reveal of what those ads are for, it's very strange.
He stumbles in, he finds a woman watching an old TV and some sort of corporate video running on it. She has no interest in talking to him. She's trying to pay close attention. So he just sits down watching with her, and then he sees a brochure, and he's just like, fucking brochure. He opens it up, less than useful. It just says, do you feel lucky? I think is what it says. And he's just like, what the fuck? Why is this on such glossy print? Like, they spent a lot of money on this, and it has nothing inside.
Well, they only have one pamphlet.
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. Yeah,
it's got a lot of COVID on it. And then Sam Neill, everybody's favorite paleontologist, walks out with the most amazing facial hair. He's got a full on white beard, but then he has a waxed up mustache as part of it. And, it was very distracting. It was like that was probably a Muppet special effect, because, I could not keep my eyes off of that magical beast.
I mean, he has been in some shit ass movies. Like, there's no hiding that, but he's still just when he wants to, he can just turn that shit on. And I think he did an incredible job with the character. I liked his character probably the most out of all the supporting cast, just because of how consistent and different it was from things I've kind of seen him play.
So. Well, I was trying to figure out, because to kind of like give the audience a sense of like what his performance is like, he's got like this very weird physical gait, and he's playing, there's like a lot of Roald Dahl feel to this movie, and he's playing his character in this like extreme Charlie and the Chocolate Factory kind of like angle, where he's like incredibly rude and mean-spirited all the time, but he's got like this physical like hunch to him that then becomes plot relevant later. But early on, I couldn't tell whether he was phoning it in by like going so hard because he was like, nobody gives a shit, or whether he was doing something. By the end, I feel like, yeah, Sam Neill was actually having fun with this movie and probably believed in what he was doing.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the doll reference is pretty spot on, you know, just especially to how his mean-spiritedness towards our main character, which is just like a staple in doll's writing and stuff. And so he's leading out this applicant.
He has a great line here where he's like, so what do you do here? Because there's a running joke of not knowing what the company is. And he turns to the other guy. He's like, we do what we can. And then he keeps going. And I love that. I was like, all right, I'm on board for Sam Neill in this movie.
Well, he walks out the other applicant, and she's like, just have fun with it. And he's just like, I assure you, these other interviews are just a formality, just like in front of them. And then Paul, who has stumbled in, he didn't know he was going to be there. Here comes Sam Neill. Dennis Tanner is his character name. He's just like, Paul Carpenter. And just like he was expecting him. In a way, it's revealed, like, you figure out later, just like, well, okay, all right, okay.
Even though also kind of not, because we'll get to that.
Yeah. Expecting him, but hoping not to see him, is, I guess, a more accurate description there. And so then Paul's just like, oh, okay, whatever. And you go to a little room, you meet Christoph Waltz's character. He's playing Humphrey Wells, the son of John Wells, who is the owner of the company, who's been on all the marketing and all that shit that we've been seeing, and our table of other people, and they're just asking him like random questions of like, tell us about yourself and blah blah blah,
and they're like the TV announcers from The Hunger Games, where they've all like got a visual gimmick to them Yeah. One guy's got beautiful mustache, and
another one's like, you want to talk about a good mustache? That guy, yeah. Like his mustache. Oh my God.
He should have been in more of the movie just so we could have gotten more of that sweet stash, but.
Well, and he had a great voice. I was like, wow.
He did. And he was also.
His name is Kashmir.
Like, yeah, he's interesting. That's one of the worst things about this movie is when I saw this lineup of characters, I was like, oh, cool. We're going to kind of like, all of these guys are going to have their own like Hogwarts gimmick. Cause there's also a lot of like Harry Potter vibes in this movie in certain places. Like this is like Harry Potter for people who are in like the shitty workforce. And you have all these characters like, oh, cool. We're going to get to know them. And then we really don't like.
Yeah. Now that you mentioned that, that is kind of like, now that we're back at this scene, I guess it is. Probably like the biggest disappointment of the movie is you just don't get to know these characters. They all get their one scene.
Because this is a novel too. Like I wondered about that midway through. Is this a novel? And yeah, it's a series of novels. I don't know if they're for kids, but I'm assuming in the book, like all these characters get a lot more beats the same way like the Harry Potter movies had to strip out a whole bunch of ancillary shit because it just can't fit it.
Well, I mean, that totally makes sense. And they definitely leave the door open, but it's for a sequel, so.
Yeah.
They're asking him questions. He's telling them about his day, and they're all just like, go on, tell us more. And they're all just like super interested on everything that happened to him to get him to where he was. And then the whole entire time, he's just like distracted by this like stain on the wall, and he's just like, I'm sorry, just it's like that's London, that's a map of London right there, you know. He's like, that's this. He like runs it through it, and like no one else like sees what he's seeing, you know. Humphrey like takes a look real quick of like, what the fuck is he talking about, and then like looks back like, ah, yeah, no, I know what he's talking about. He's definitely not seeing shit that I can't see. That's not what's happening here at all. And then they just kind of kick him on his way. He goes back home, and we meet his shitty roommate who has had an epiphany and is leaving to go live with his parents, essentially. We need to, like, he commits to this sitting on the couch very aggressively. He was like, I am not filming this more than a couple times because I'm going to firmly plant my ass as hard on this ground as possible. I'm sure they had something to break his cushion because otherwise he would have been standing up going, my fucking tailbone, my fucking tailbone. Instead, he was just like, where's the couch? And his shitty roommate is taking the shitty couch back to his shitty parents' house. And I was like, I don't think your parents want you to have this shitty couch. Leave the shitty couch, man.
He's essentially giving up on the London dream. He's like, I don't want to do the normal thing. I just kind of want to be a slacker and just sit on a couch at home in whatever part of the country I'm from. So.
Yeah, that's a great dream, to be quite honest. He was the most level-headed out of anyone in this story. I was like, go, Neville. You do it. Live that.
And his performance is big enough that you almost expect him to come back. But yeah, no, this is the end of Neville.
This is the end. Maybe he shows up in book two or something. And then we see some creepy fingers slip a note under or through the mail slot. He's got the job. He's going to show up at 9 a.m. for a paid internship. He has no idea what he does. So. But the next day goes better for him. He's able to put on a suit and show up on time. The lobby looks very different. I don't know how they fucking pull that shit off overnight.
Well, the joke is that they were renovating. Like, they keep having characters go like, oh, we love the new renovation. But, yeah, the building's completely turned over to this hyper sci-fi aesthetic, which I thought, considering Amazon had it described as a sci-fi, was going to pay off in some way. But this is firmly a fantasy film.
Yeah, I mean, I just thought it was like very, I don't know, I hate to say Harry Potter inspired shit, but it just kind of did. It seemed like, you know, like if Blade Runner inspired wallpaper, that's what they put on a lot of things.
Yeah, I also got like strong Doctor Who vibes off of parts of it, especially the premise. So there was a lot of the visual choices where it's like, yeah, this looks kind of like Doctor Who with money. But now we get the introduction of, you know, if Sam Neill had any competition in this movie for who my favorite character is, the receptionist.
Yeah.
Who is playing this role in such a big way, I assumed she was going to be the secret villain. They have this running thing where they have White Queen laundry care out front. And every exterior shot, there are some people loading towels into this van. And I assumed that was the secret bad guy. She was the White Queen. She was manipulating everything. And this weird hyper contempt that she exudes to every character below her was going to pay off in some way. But nope, she's just real fucking weird.
says some shit to Paul. Like, they all, what I enjoy is that you see flashes of it the most right here with the receptionist.
Yeah.
I think, is her name Rosie, they call her? They all kind of talk about Paul like they know what he's doing, you know? And it makes sense later when there's other shit revealed. But I really enjoyed that. And I felt like that's part of why they talked down to him is because they could. They were like, I know you. Like, you don't know how much I know you. And that's why I'm talking to you like this. Because right. I'm annoyed that you don't know how much I know you.
And so. It should be mentioned that we haven't really gotten into it, but our lead is an incredible putz. Like, he is the yeah. classic British protagonist where he's just constantly like mumble mouthing every conversation he has. He's super apologetic. He's such a put upon guy, and everybody, the funny thing is everyone responds to him with extreme contempt. Like, even yeah. characters I think we're supposed to like treat him terribly, and it makes some of like changes in dynamic and relationships seem like they come out of nowhere, because our character doesn't really change all that much. Up until the end, he's still pretty much this like mealy mouthed putz.
Yeah. But I mean, at the same time, it's like, well, that's just some people, you know? Like, I mean, yeah. I don't know. Sometimes I'm okay when there's not this huge character change, and it's more of like the world sees you for who you are rather than who they want you to be type of thing. And I kind of, that's sure. the kind of the vibe I got off of this, which could just be me, but.
I think the thing is when it comes to the Harry Potter comparison, like, the nice thing about Harry Potter was, when the character comes into Hogwarts and people treat him like different characters treat him different ways based on what they kind of know about him. Mm-hmm. And you understand more about Harry Potter based on how people react to him. So like some people are trying to be his friend, but then turn on him when he reveals he doesn't have these things, or some people hate him outright. And this character, everyone hates this guy. Like, he doesn't have a single like friend character. There's no Hagrid for this dude. Everyone's just yeah, like, I mean, fuck you. Who are you, you piece of shit?
Well, and I think that's because of who has hired him, which.
That's fair.
We can speed up to that a little bit. So Sam Neill's character comes and gets him, treats him like the stain on the earth that they can't get rid of.
Lower than the mites by his own definition.
Yes, yes. And then they go through just, he tries to get through these cross beams in the weirdest of fucking ways while. Well, Paul just kind of shimmies to the side of it, and you're just like, what the fuck is going on? And then it's like, boom, there's the stapler.
Stapler.
And he fucking stops in his tracks, like, oh, 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 and then just kind of slowly walks around it, and Paul's just like, what the fuck is up with this guy? And then taken to the intern room, I guess. It's like a storage closet B or some shit, because they're just like, no, you're lesser than storage closet A. You're in B. And then there's Sophie, and they are just sitting there. They have no idea what to do. He talks way too much.
This was a scene drinking. That kind of turned on the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. This scene was, it was bad for characters. It was bad for the movie. It was just a bad scene. There's another one with these two characters. I think when they're at the bar together, equally bad, you know, not as bad as this one, but. Fucking pretty damn close, you know? I said so equally, I meant almost.
Yeah. The scene is the traditional one where a character constantly makes very, very mild double entendres and gets flustered in front of a hot girl. And this movie, and immediately when you know that happens, these characters are going to fall in love. Unfortunately, yeah. every single character in the movie is going to remind you insistently that these two characters are going to fall in love. And except for one scene in the movie, I never got an ounce of chemistry, genuine romantic chemistry between these two leads. It's sad. You feel like this woman is going to be burdened by this character's romantic interest. Like, you are.
I'd like to think that all women are burdened by the movie. Okay.
Fair.
Is that not true love to be a burden on your significant other?
But yeah, it's like, that's the worst part of the scene is it's not funny. It wastes time, and it's not establishing anything character wise other than, oh shit, you're putting us on a train track to Love Town without any of the work of actually making us like these characters. We're just supposed to find his awkwardness adorable, and that's supposed to propel this shit all the way to the last station, and it does not work for me.
I mean, it works for me, but I'll go into, I'll counter when it happens and stuff. So
when it happens, I will admit, because I think I know what we're talking about, and I do like that scene.
I think Rosie shows up and then gives them maps and says, find the fucking element that is used for, I don't know, aluminum or some shit.
It's like borite or
borexy or something.
Borexy, yeah. Some sort of obscure element.
Yeah.
And you're just supposed to look at these maps and neither, I guess the female lead knows how to find it because she seems competent, even though we find out later why they're being asked to find this thing, which is strange.
Yeah. Needless to say, neither of them find shit because the type of maps that they're looking at are, they're like topography maps, so there's like no fucking way they would be able to find anything.
Sure.
And then the Countess comes in. She's just like, Sophie, I got a fucking job for you. I really, really, for a second here, I just processed that her character name and her real name are the same, and that had to have been kind of fucking annoying for her. Or lazily. They were just like, okay, you don't seem to really be responding to Becky, so we're going to call you Sophie, just your real name, because Jesus Christ, you're not helping here. So, or just by weird coincidence, they were like, we found our Sophie, and her name is fucking Sophie. And they're just like, oh, well, that worked out well. But anyways, Kanta's like, I got a job for you. Thumble nuts, you can come with us. Just don't fucking do anything, okay? If you fucking do anything, it's going to fuck everything up. Just don't do it.
Everybody's going on a field trip, and our lead character keeps asking, what do you do here? Because he still doesn't know.
He still has no fucking clue, which is fair. If I was in that same situation, I'd be like, what are we going to do?
Yeah, which I was hoping would carry on further, but we're about to find out what this is all about.
We're going to find out. Some cancer pops up from under the ground. Again, seeing like a little strange hand. Makes no, you know, mention of it. And then she's like, okay, Sophie, you're going to see that woman, when she gets to this part, I need you to let me know. Like, you need to signal that she's at this part. And she's like, what am I supposed to do? Read over shoulder? She's like, no, you're going to read over there. Sophie goes into some, like, little trance thing where she can basically, at this point, we just feel like she's seeing the book. But really what it is, she's reading her mind and she doesn't know it. She's searing, I guess, is the terminology they use for it. She signals when she gets to the part and then the Countess makes something else happen, and then this guy that was sitting on the fountain like an asshole falls into the fountain, and then we have a cute meet. Okay, she comes back over to her, she's like, great job. His parents paid a fortune for that. Bada bing, bada boom, they'll talk about it forever. Coincidences happen. Love has been found. And so he's just like, we make people fall in love. And she's like, no, we do a lot of shit, dickhead. He's like, god damn it. I'll never figure out my job. So, but part of it is, like, one division of it, you could say, is making people fall in love, or making, I guess is a better way to say it, is making things happen that seem fated but are not. They're actually orchestrated and controlled.
It's a very weird thing where they're running a for-profit business of manufacturing coincidences that will have monumental or insignificant effects based on who's paying for it. But they essentially credit like every major technological innovation of the last like however many years to a for pay service that manufactures coincidences, which leads to a lot of inherent questions, which would be ignorable if it wasn't for where things go with this. But yeah, that is what they do. Coincidence for money.
And
they never
Sophie,
say how much. They just say too little.
Well, I like that vague terms, you know? It's like, this is the one of the few times where I'm not going to get, like, hung up on the economics of it, because I'm also just like, well, this is a big fancy-ass building. So they might not be doing that terribly.
But how many people, like, because that's the weird thing. They have a huge fancy building.
Well, they got a lot of free labor. You know?
And they do have a lot of free labor. And, but then they have these, like, people wearing, like, really nice suits and seem like they have expensive tastes. And it's, and then these huge staffs that are not the free labor, and it's like, okay.
Actually, they're the free labor too.
Are they all?
Yeah.
So why do we have characters that aren't the free labor?
Guinea pigs.
I guess. Maybe they're the only ones that could be psychic. Maybe the other free labor can't have magic powers other than the magic powers they have already.
Paul's back, he's searching maps, and then he starts feeling stuff in his hands, or Christoph Waltz, pops around the corner, and he's just like, don't touch the map! Hover your hand over it, just barely. And he keeps like trying to put Paul's fucking hand further down, and Paul's like fighting him. He's just like, hey, motherfucker. Academy nominated, all right? Stop it. Let me control your hand, okay? And he's just like, you just feel the map. And then a little zip-zap happens on the map, and he's just like, you got the juice. So he takes him on a walk. And this is one of the first random scene I saw when they were going through the typewriters, or the fax machines, I mean, and they're just like printing shit, like nonstop.
Yeah.
And he's just like, what is this doing? He's just like, no idea. just doing stuff. And I happened to walk into the room and see that scene, and I was just like, this is visually interesting. And the way he's just nonchalantly like, I don't know. It's just here. You know?
The production design of this movie is like really engaging in a lot of places. Like it does look real good.
And just like that little scene, it just stayed with me visually. I was just like, okay. And then eventually he leads him back to his office, and he's like, I need your help finding a door. Or like, well, I think he says finding something here, you know? And then, Dennis is there, and Dennis is like, it's a door, a portable door. And he's just like, thank you, Dennis. Thank you.
He's building up to
something. And then Dennis is like, it's a fucking door. I couldn't wait. I had to.
There's this bit in there where he's like picking his like ear or his nose or something. And then he's like, cause the other characters are delivering exposition. Sam Neill's just like looking for a really long time at whatever he's just pulled out of his body. Cause he's just like showing like, this is how little of a shit I give about this situation. I'm just going to keep looking at this junk I pulled out of myself. It's really fucking funny.
And then this is another like foreshadowing scene, because Humphrey's just like, you know, you and me, we're a lot alike. You know, I bet your parents were so proud of you. And Dennis goes off, and he's just like, his parents barely even noticed him. His father left him in a shopping dime, and his mother was too busy to pay attention with her three affairs. And he's like, wait, who was the third affair? And I like that line, because it's like he knew about two of them, but he was like, wait, third? And then we get Humphrey's backstory, where his father made him sign over his soul to him as a young boy. And I was just like, and you're definitely the villain now.
Okay? Right. It's like a little, it shows hand too much.
You know?
Yeah.
Like if your father makes you sign over your soul, they're not the villain. I mean, they're a little villainy, but they have high villain suspicions of you at an early age, and they're gonna ring that shit in. And Christoph is just like, who does that to a child? You know, and it's his charming little accent he has. And that's when he's just like, I want you to find something here. You know, and he's like, it's a door. He's like, it's a portable door, and you're only gonna find it when you stop looking for it. And you can't tell anyone you're looking for it, okay? So just do that.
It can hide, is the thing. It's got like this low level TARDIS like sentience.
I think, you know, and that kind of wraps up the day. They're also explicitly told numerous times they can't stay past 5 o'clock. They got to get the fuck out at 5. Don't be, you know, a brown noser. No one gives a shit about you trying to work overtime. Just get out. Get out. And I think doesn't he, go with Sophie at that point, or is that the next day?
I feel like they start bonding lightly. It's the coffee moment where Sophie has all these like really prominent things that she dislikes. And one of them is like the smell of coffee. And she says, oh, let's go to, I'll get some lunch. And he's like, oh, I'll go with you to lunch. She's like, maybe I'll get a coffee. And he's like, you hate coffee. And she's like, yeah. Yeah, I do.
She's like, why'd I say that?
Right.
Oh, he gets, this is the dream sequence though. Like that night.
Right. This
Casimir invades his dreams to find out the truth from him. And I guess this was probably the more Jim Hansen-y thing, too, even though they use a lot more CGI than the previous iterations of the company, where they bend his foot. He makes all of his teeth fall out, which I thought was very cool looking, just because of just how goofy it kind of came across. I was like, those teeth are too big. Like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, like, Casimir is torturing our character. Yeah. For information, which this scene I want to come back to later when we see Casimir again. But yeah, it's like a weird horror dream sequence. And this would be like the headless creatures from Labyrinth scene, where it's going to traumatize a kid who's going to always remember this.
Oh, for sure. Cause then like his ears are stretched, and then he wakes up and he's like, oh, it's just a dream. And then Casimir's still there. He's just like, you're still in a dream. And he's like, ah, and like just terrified of the man again. And then he's on his way back to work. And then it's when he runs into Casimir again. And he's just like, hey, it's me from the thing. And he just like holds his ears like, oh,
but he doesn't, Casimir acts like he doesn't remember the scene, which confused me.
Yeah. I was confused by that too. Cause I was like,
yeah. Cause it never comes up. We never have an explanation for. Because the secondary characters, he's also confronted by the woman from Wilder People. And
yeah. Oh, I think isn't she right after he leaves the office or something?
Yeah, I feel like she's in like, an earlier scene when he's looking for the door. Because he's doing a bunch of, like, waving his hands.
Yeah, yeah, that's after he gets the task. He's just in that first hallway we see, and he's just putting his hand on fucking everything. And
but both of these characters are entirely irrelevant to the solution to this movie and really just show up for a cameo at the end. So I feel like this probably would have been important in the book, but in the movie, it's like you could have cut that dream sequence and your film would have made a little more sense.
But I mean, her hair says beware, which is, I thought was cool. I was like, oh, that's cool. And she's like, eyes down here. He's like, huh? Okay. I mean, your hair is doing things and stuff. Yeah. And so the second day goes, he's looking for shit. He still is not having any luck at the door. And then he goes down to this, basement level where it says goblins only, you know, if you're a human or whatever, if you're someone else, go with that down here without Dennis Tanner's approval, like get out of here. And so he opens the door and it's just like this weird, I guess, storage of just like stuff. Like
it's like janitor's overflow closet. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like visually interesting stuff. Like I was just like, yeah, go through that stuff. I want to see that stuff. You know, what's that jar of stuff in that box? What does that box got in it? You know, Dennis comes down. He's just like, I don't recall telling you you could be down here. And you're just like, how the fuck do you know he's down there? You know, so it's just his character, I guess, you know.
Well, we've seen these little grimy claw hands all over the place. So we're like, oh, okay. Yeah. Grimy claw hands are goblins. We have goblins in this film. And we've already had a baby dragon pop up for a cameo, not really worth mentioning because that baby dragon, for being set up in the very first scene, has zero relevance to the end of the movie too. It was kind of strange how they didn't even have like a featured moment for the baby dragon. It's like, look how cute our CGI model is. Just felt like they were trying to, it was like a baby Yoda moment where it's like, this is the toy that you sell if you're going to like have any popularity for this movie.
I just don't think you get to see it enough to really be like, that's adorable, you know, so.
Well, exactly. I was weirded out by the fact that the dragon didn't hang out with them for the last bit of the movie. Presumably, it should have been following them around. It was probably too expensive.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's why it turned into a mouse at the end. It was like, I'm a mouse. It's like, no, okay. This is the part where, you know, eventually he goes to leave with Sophie, and she grabs, like, this big-ass handful of licorice and eats it, like, just fucking crams all of it in her mouth.
Yeah.
And just childishly looks at him like, oh, I'm eating licorice. And he's just like, the fuck's wrong with you? And even the other guy in the lobby is just like, what the hell's wrong with you? And she's like, I don't know why I did that. You know, he's like, you want to get a beer? And he's just like, yes, drinks. Yay. My joke paid off. It did not. It did fucking not. And then they get the smallest pints I've ever seen in a movie in the UK. They were childlike glasses of alcohol, definitely apple juice and those fucker things. And they just start, I don't know, they just start like talking shit at each other. Like,
yeah.
He just starts kind of calling around like, oh, you're Mrs. Fast Track, blah, blah, blah. And she's just like, you have a special job, don't you? And he's like, no, maybe, yeah, totally.
So they missed a joke here because she describes him as somewhat good looking during her big razzing of him.
I know, yeah.
And then I was like,
Well, there's that awkward moment, and that's why I hate both these scenes.
Long pause, and then you should have gone like, do you think I'm good looking?
So a manly? I was waiting for it. I was just like,
yep. Uh-huh. And then they just walk out.
Like, we should go.
It's so weird how they don't even like take the easy bait. Like that's how that scene ends in any other of these kinds of movies. 100%.
Yeah. Like the minute she said it was just like, okay, we're acknowledging that later. We have to.
Yeah.
And they were just like, no. And then possibly one of my favorite things. Oh, and I think at this, we missed one part where Rosie's making out with the stapler.
Right. She's licking it and giving it the full like strip tease. Yeah. She's like, I love office supplies.
And then he shows up to work and she's like, having a fight on your first date? And he's just like, what? How do you, what? So, and, I think we missed a scene where, like, Sophie's being led around and she asks, like, hey, how are you getting these cancers? And that's when, the Countess is like, goblins, you know? So how else would we? They mentioned that they're nosy, that, like, they love being following humans and they love watching everything they do, but they also hate them. You know.
They love stealing little things, even though that doesn't really pay off, but they're pickpockets.
So, but I mean, it just goes to explain his bad first day.
So does he go down to the janitor closet again after this? Like,
he does, and this is the second scene I saw where the guy who pretended to be his teacher later on, or in the beginning, is trying to stop him. And he's like, Mr. Tanner told me to stop you. And he's just like, he goes, he's very creative with his punishment, so I need to listen to him. And you're just like, oh, okay. You know, and that's the thing. It's like those little things where it's like we don't see it, but them saying it and the way they deliver it leaves more of an impression on how Tanner is. And then you pair that with how he's acted towards Paul, and it makes his character a little bit terrifying.
Well, the first visit to the janitor closet, too, I forgot about this. Tanner's describing all the things Christoph Waltz would do to the character if he caught him. And it's like, it's very Roald Dahl kind of things where he's like, baked, sliced, you know, like flambéed. He's using like all these like food and murder terms. And it's like, it is weird because, again, I don't know who this movie's being made for. I think Amazon said it was PG-13. That's impossible because there's no way this movie is like, it feels like a G, honestly.
But it's like PG poster I'm seeing here where they actually rated it, so
I feel like the little opening card said PG-13, which set my expectations higher. But yeah, it feels more kid friendly, but then you'll have these little things that give it that little edge of like, okay, there's a world of threat here. Some of these characters are legitimately dangerous. We just don't understand the dimensions yet of what that means.
Oh, so he gets past the guy, he goes back down to the basement, he goes through, he tries to, you know, touch the shit, and then, like, this wall, like, melts, and, it's decent visual.
For a lazy way of doing that, it looked really good. I was actually surprised how nice the effect was.
And then he kind of just walks through, and he finds what I assume is the room you were talking about before, the craft.
It's just a room full of magical shit. A lot of eyeballs on things, primarily. It's almost entirely
like a star
object that has an eyeball. Yeah. Magical room full of magical stuff. And what's at the end of the magical room?
The stapler.
Well, not that one, but yeah, also the stapler.
The cauldron?
No, I mean.
You mean the door?
Yeah, well, but there's a stapler, and the stapler, I guess, is important. I've totally fucking blanked on the stapler.
Yeah, because he sees the stapler, and he's like, what the fuck? And then he's kind of figured out his hand. Like, he listens to his hand. He's just like, hand, what do we got here? And the hand's just like, I'm going to smack the shit out of you. Okay, I got a goblin over here. He's like, a fucking goblin, you say? And he's like, yeah, man, I got a goblin. Just, do you see that goddamn stapler? He's like, yeah, it's a big stapler. It's old school. He's like, yeah, wave your hand on it, man. And he waves his hand. He's just like, oh, fuck his shoes. And he, like, jumps back. He's like, the fuck? And then he just starts slowly, he's like, oh, what is this? Oh, it's gonna be a creepy old man, I just know it. And then he just gets up and he's like, oh god, it's a fucking goblin. And the goblin's just like,
I thought it was like a haunted mansion ghost, honestly, because I kept expecting the goblins to look more puppety. Like, I thought we were gonna get like full on like little munchies style goblins, but instead, the goblins just look like zombies, kind of.
Well, they kind of look like gremlins, too, if they had turned into people at the end.
They're real cheap, and they just used Halloween masks, kind of.
Yeah. And I kind of thought, I was like, oh, cool, they're, like, camouflaged all the time as, like, objects in front of us or whatever. But that actually kind of isn't necessarily the case. That's kind of a punishment of sorts that we learn later. But then there's the fucking door, and then he opens the door. And there's, I don't know what he thinks something. He must have thought something before he opened the door, because I forget where he
is. No, I think the door leads him to the first clue, because it's the exit.
Oh, right, It takes him to Humphrey's office.
Right outside the office.
And then he closes the door, and it turns into a towel. Through this, he hears Humphrey's evil plan. It's just that he has so much romance in his heart, he cannot process this evil plan that he is hearing, which is Operation Fine Print. the gist of it is maddening now that I think about it, because it's so just
Hate this so much.
Well, I love the plot. I love the idea. It's just more of like the fact that he didn't go, oh yeah, by the way, your soul's in hell by the, you know, just, it's in the bank of the dead. Like instantly to Sophie. But, so basically by signing any sort of fine print, they can add, they will get your soul and be able to control your soul, which from the consumer standpoint, that means they can sell you whatever they want to sell you. And just have total control of your life. And they use Sophie as an example of like, she hated coffee. Now she likes coffee. She hated licorice. Now she likes licorice, you know?
Yeah. So they have jazz. A room full
now
of.
She's really into fucking Miles Davis's experimental, jazz fusion shit or acid fusion.
Yeah. They have a, like a room full of like, I guess investor types where it's like, he's walking around. It's like, we can make people believe whatever you want. We can sell them any old shit. We can get them to vote Yang Gang. Like they're just going around saying we'll be able to control people and make them like respond to marketing better. But yeah. The weird thing about this is like these characters are so powerful and already do a job for money that should be like the most expensive fucking thing, like discovering the bomb. Like they're already the most powerful beings on the planet. And like their plan is to make better money by doing the same job they were already kind of doing. Like, but more straightforward. I have no idea how this is supposed to be clever. And it really, another thing is like, this is also kind of the most evil that we get out of Humphreys. And so when we're selling him as like a Machiavellian evil character, where one character is literally talking about, he was like an evil little boy. It's like, we don't really get a sense for how bad this guy is, because his plan just kind of seems like normal shitty bad evil rather than like, oh no, like this guy's like Voldemort Hitler.
Yeah, it's more of like, I guess in a way, it's just he's really hung up on the credit, you know? They don't get any of the credit.
But people can't get credit for this, because if they find out that they're all being manipulated because their souls are in Hellbank, yeah. I don't understand how this changes the dynamic of what they get out of this.
No, I mean, yeah. No, I mean, it's a totally fair point, because it's really just... I mean, it's just a clever Operation Fine Print, you know, and then
that was
no one,
fun,
oh,
yeah.
No one reads the fine print. You're just, yeah, we know.
It's a very cutesy British, like, children's book thing to be like, oh, the fine print is where you're going to, if you click yes on the Apple product, you're going to be a human centipede kind of thing.
Yeah, which is like the whole, you know, Apple joke or,
South Park. South
Park
one, yeah.
And then he's like, okay, I got to get the fuck out of here, you know, cause, Dennis is, I love when he's like, he does like the fidget spinner projector thing upside down, and he has to come over and like switch it in his hand. He's like this, you fucking.
Oh, that was a weird moment.
Yeah, just kind of to show like the general kind of like still incompetence of Dennis, because there's still been moment like when he came in his shirt untucked,
yeah.
And Rosie's like, Dennis, your shirt, and he's just like, and you're like, which, you know, now thinking about it, that makes way more sense based on who she is in the end,
right?
Right, that, yeah, yeah. But so then he picks up the towel, he reads the tag, because that's what I would do if I had a magical fucking towel that was once a door. I'd be like, well, where's the tag? I gotta read the tag.
I wouldn't have assumed it was the door. Like,
I wouldn't have made that
connection.
Now there's a towel. It says, you know, hold it up, say knock knock, and then think of where you want to go before you open the door. You will go there. So he does it very quickly, and he says supermarket, and then he's just in the freezer section of the supermarket, and then he just looks like he's stealing a towel from the supermarket in front of a guy who's, I don't know why he's dressed so sharply for the grocery shop, but he fucking is. He's looks like he walked out of a nightclub and just went shopping. Dennis goes back to work through the front door, and here's the thing, everyone's very aware of who goes and leaves and where they go and they leave from. So Rosie's just like, where the fuck do you come from? But she doesn't say anything. She's just like, I'm on to you, Carpenter. And then he goes up and he finds Sophie, and he's like, okay, let me show you this thing. And she's like,
oh, we missed a thing, because an important part of this is Sophie has been part of this experiment. The reason why she likes coffee and the reason why she likes licorice.
No, I covered
now.
That. Yeah.
Oh, did we? Okay. But like,
oh, well, I
kind of
covered it, but I didn't go into.
Yeah, like explicitly she is the kind of like guinea pig for all this.
Yeah,
so they're using her. Yeah. They literally show her during the thing. So he's like panicking and trying to tell her like, your soul is in hell.
But is he?
I mean, not enough.
But is he gives like a half a second. He's like, let me hear this door and then I might might mention the fact that they have your soul. He goes to show her, and then he doesn't say where he wants to go. He says it. He says supermarket. Like, he's opened the door, and then he says supermarket. And then he goes, and there's, like, this room full of doors, and they hear a voice. And he does, I guess, what any rational human being does. And he goes, ah, I'm terrified. And he closes the door, and he does not figure out. Because, as Justin said, he's a putz. He has no bravery to him. And he just closes that fucking door.
Because it's a shit ton of doors, and they all have, like, glowing door handles, where when you're not looking at them close and don't realize what they are, it just kind of looks like futuristic room. And then you just realize, oh, it's shit ton of doors, shit ton of glowing doorknobs. And I really did like the look of that set.
I loved it, yeah. I mean, it was very Doctor Who-ish, but also, yeah. Like, it was just clever. It was just, like, a clever design. You know?
Yeah. The glowing door handles made it more interesting than what it would have been if they hadn't made that little touch.
And so then I think he goes, like, my flat or something. And so he takes her to his flat, and then she's like, you're tidier than I expected. And then she's just like, wait, we can go anywhere. And then she's just like, let's fucking go.
Yeah, this is the best job ever now.
Yeah. And they're just like, hey, did you ever see Jumper? Well,
yeah.
We're about to do Jumper, but with romance, and they go to the pyramids, and just, and I like this part. I was
this
just
is
like,
my favorite
yes,
scene
that's
in
what
the
you
movie.
Should do with the fucking door. You know, you should go to a private beach. You know, you should be bringing bikinis to work and shit. I mean, I laughed really hard when he got his ass up off that sand and he was sitting on the towel that was the door. I was like, dude, you can't use that's your magical door. Don't be sitting your wet ass on it. Are you kidding me?
I would be so terrified of damaging it.
Exactly. Yeah. I had two towels. You know, it's like, no, that was not a towel. You never think of it as a towel. Okay.
Again, like, they're getting like Coney Island hot dogs and just dabbing their mouths on the corner.
He's just like, blah, 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 blah. She's just like, you know, we should probably wash this sometimes. He's like, fuck no, I can't wash a door. Are you kidding me, Sophie? Well, then we should at least stop wiping our mouths on it. No, that's never going to happen. I will wipe for the rest of my life.
So the reason why this is the one scene of the movie where I actually gave these characters credit, because it doesn't do anything amazing. I totally thought of Jumper when I saw this scene.
Yeah, no, the minute
it was very cute.
Anytime you go to pyramids, I'm like, Jumper.
Yeah, but it was very cute, and it was whimsical in the right way. And the main thing is this is the only moment in the movie where the characters act like characters that are making choices rather than characters that are being driven by the necessities of the plot. Like, yeah. Both of these characters are so kind of like mechanically doing the things that their archetype is supposed to. And the moments where these two characters are hanging out and being romantic, I was like, whoa, I've had nothing leading up to the moment for me buying these characters being in love as much as I am right now, because they look like they're having fun and they look like they're on a magical adventure. And it made me want to have that magical door and do that magical shit. And fuck if I wish the movie kept up that energy going forward, but it didn't for me.
But it was already an hour into the movie when this hit.
Yeah, because so, it is a long movie. Like, it's over 2 hours.
Like, but I was like, when do we find the door? Hour mark, almost exact. I was just like, all right. I mean, I'm going to play devil's advocate with you, though, of like, sure. Yes, they are, you know, adhered to their circumstances when driving the plot forward. But in a way, that is kind of what the plot is about, you know, of like, you know, controlling these coincidences and stuff, and like, how much free choice do you have, or how much of it is really being controlled for you? So them not having it, and then suddenly they get the door and they have freedom, you know, like they get to open the door, they get to pick what they do, they get to do what they want. And in a way, it is kind of like that explains the big switch, because they are taking themselves out of the control of their handlers in a way. So I don't know. I mean,
yeah, that's fair. I do have the weird thing, though, where we have the coincidences that led him to getting the job. And when you realize the company orchestrates coincidences, that's like, oh, there's going to be a reveal at some point for why he got that job that way. But ultimately, it made him getting the job make less sense, because nobody knew about his special talent before he went into that job interview. So there is no reason why anyone was orchestrating the coincidences. Essentially, those coincidences were natural.
Yeah.
Nobody ended up making those coincidences happen.
But that's why I kind of like that, because, you know, we'll just talk about, like, Tanner and the other goblins were actively orchestrating it against him. They wanted him to, you know, not be there. Well, I think the second one actually was trying to get him not to do the coffee interview.
But why?
I don't know.
That's maybe the thing. Why?
Just,
that would
maybe
that...
he just knew that there was something special about him that would maybe they could sense something. I don't know. Again, I'm doing more of the work for them, and maybe it's something from the book that doesn't translate well into the movie.
Yeah.
Thing, you know, his was a natural coincidence, fighting against a man-constructed coincidences in a way or something. So.
Except apparently not, because that goblin does tell him, like, oh, yeah, no, I was told to do that and make you miss your interview. Regardless, it doesn't really matter. All it is like, there's a lot about, like, the structure of this. This is a movie that really wants to be clever. That's the thing that bothers me. There's a lot of little things they set up to be paid off, like the stapler, which we'll find out what's going on with that. All that stuff's in there. But then the structure of the movie is so painfully unclever that I don't feel any sort of like intelligence to how it's structured. It wants to be like Dirk Gently. It wants to have that Douglas Adams Hitchhiker's Guide. We're doing crazy things, but it's all going to make sense in this really fucked up kind of way. It doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't hold water.
I mean, I think that's fair, because I mean, I think those are the things that like people, they want. But even then, it's like the first time, you know, I had a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy experience, and I still have never really finished the book or whatever. It was just like, yeah, no, I kind of hate this for like 95% of the movie. And then it's just when the cleverness plays off that you're just like, oh, okay. I don't mind everything I just went through, you know, but like sometimes that's just how I guess it is. It's just like some people are just like, I'm down 100%. And then others are just like, that last five is all you're going to get from me. So
I think it was that I also thought it was going to be more absurdist when they had the stapler as something that was threatening. I kept expecting it to be like, oh, we're creating like this weird world with rules that's going to matter. And it's just like, it's funky on the outside, but it does kind of make sense in this, you know, trippy sort of David Lynch, you know, like how David Lynch can have fucking canned corn be human misery. And it's like, it's a symbol for something, but as long as you understand the payoff, then okay, I get it. But no, it's goblins and wizards and dragons. It's like literally the most basic fantasy stuff. There's no like, none of this pays off in an interesting way. It's goblins, wizards, and dragons. That's literally everything.
Yeah. And then so eventually, after several dates and a lot of romance, he's like, how do you, Sophie, how do you feel about me? And Sophie's like, well, I don't really trust my instincts. Ever since I took this job, everything's felt like off and shit. And he's like, oh, that's because they have your soul. Yeah. It's in this whole fine print thing. And he's like, you know what? I am motivated now to get your soul for you so that I can find out if these feelings are real for me. Cause that's
which
what's
I did
really
like.
Important to me.
And the way she seems really conflicted and like worried, I bought that completely. And I was like, that's a cool motivation. I like that she's questioning this relationship because I'm not buying it. So thank you.
It's good. It was good. Yeah. It was believable in that they didn't just fall fastly in love, you know? And like even by the end, and that's what I think I enjoyed about the romantic element of this is even by the end of it, we're just on the cusp of a relationship starting.
Right.
You know? We're still in infatuation. We're not even in love, you know? We're in just in infatuation still. Yeah. Even after all these romantic fucking trips and journeys and everything, we're not there yet. So they go back and, fucking Tanner comes in. He's just like, what the fuck are you guys doing here? Get out. It's 5 o'clock. And then he, sees them in beach shorts and they were just like, we're doing a theme costume party for work. And he's just like, what the fucking dumbest things I've ever heard said today. But then he sees the sand and he's just like, if I were you, I would fold it up and put it outside his door and pray he doesn't kill me. And I was just like, oh shit.
That was a really, yeah. You felt like his
genuine
line.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's hated him so much and he's actually giving him like really good earnest advice, which makes it so much scarier.
Yeah. And because it's at the same time, it's just like, okay, he hates him, but clearly there's like a, just to keep going back to the Harry Potter well, I guess there's a reason why, you know, right. And it's not necessarily he hates him for who he is or whatever, you know, it's something else that, you know, maybe is revealed in the books because it's not revealed in this movie. he's like, okay, Sophie, we're going to come back tonight when they say not to. And we're going to go into his office. That's got to be where your soul is. We'll go to your office and or his office and we'll find it. You know, Rosie packs up, closes the door, goes back inside. Yep. And that's, I was on to Rosie at that, like before this, because I was just like, no, something with that stapler. But like when she locked the doors and like was on the other side of them, I was like, she's a goblin. She's not
right.
Cute. And then, they show up and they are in my favorite area, the printers endlessly printing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they kind of like make a discovery of like, hey, what is, but they basically go exploring. They find a fire. And then they see, he sees the stapler again, and then the stapler has blocked their way with like a tray of flaming papers and shit. And he's like, let's maybe go a different way or something. And so they try to use the door again, and they end up on the opening of the Bank of the Dead, and they find, or he starts seeing a bunch of eyes and tunnels looking at them, and the tunnels all have different cities listed and shit, and you're just like, oh, okay. We got some goblin tunnels here. I know how to smoke these motherfuckers out, you know? Fire, typically. Fire. And then, I forget what happens where he eventually, they basically, oh, they're like hiding out, and, they try to escape through the door while Tanner and, Wells are having like a pissing contest, where he's just like, don't challenge me on my domain, and he turns two of the goblins into office supplies, and you're just like, oh shit, okay, that's the punishment. He turned them into office supplies so that their real form is hidden permanently. But then they try to sneak into the door, they don't say where they're going, and fucking Humphreys grabs the door, and he's like, who closes the door controls the door. And he's like, phew. And then they are in the TARDIS, like, inside. And then they hear a voice, and he's like, do you have control of the door? He like pops in on another door. He's like, they're like, what? Who the fuck are you? And he's just like, ah, you don't got shit. And he just opens the door, goes back to his corner. It's Christoph Waltz again. God, why can't I say this guy's name right today? And he is aged, but he has like a beard, but then he suddenly like de-ages himself like a little bit. And he just looks like himself again. And he's the dad, and you're just like, oh, he's playing two characters. And I think they just comb his hair a different way.
They darkened his hair for the young one.
Yeah.
They like made it like jet black, which I didn't really notice until I saw the old one. I was like, oh, that's the difference. Because yeah, there's very little difference between these two characters other than facial hair.
Yeah, I mean, he does a decent job with his performance, because the father one is, you know, he speaks a little different. He's a little softer and everything. He talks about how he's a great wizard. And then she's just like, she's just been trapped in here. And he's like, yeah, well, you know, I'll be trapped in here for all time.
I don't have to eat or drink, but you two are going to be bones.
You guys are going to die and be a mess. And I'm just going to have to stare at your bones and have nowhere to put them. And she's just like, what the fuck?
Which is a really funny idea. Yeah. Just like him. He's like, this place stinks. Shit. Yeah,
and again, it's that, that doll way of saying, he says it so nonchalantly, like, yeah, this is actually like a really horrible thing for her. Like, she's gonna die, decompose, yes, he's gonna be left with a mess waiting for it, and then just bones after that, of just like, ugh, what do I do with these bones? Like,
what am I gonna do with the pile of shit from the last few bowel movements they made before they crapped out?
Yeah. He's like, oh, thank you for that. It smells wonderful. This is an enclosed room with no airflow. And meanwhile, Paul's just like, I'm going to find us a way out, motherfuckers. And so he's just opening doors. Finally, he listens to his hand. He's like, the hand's just like, hey, motherfucker, I'm going to hit you again. He's just like, come on, hand. No, focus. He's like, all right. Yeah, I think if you just like stop being a dick for a minute, this door will be the one. And so he opens it, and he's just like, hey, I found one that goes somewhere. Did you now? Did you? So they finally exit, and
they're literally John back Wolf at the Senior office.
Yeah, they're right, not anywhere in the front interesting. Where the White Queen laundry is never leaving, because they have so many goddamn towels in this place.
Yeah.
And then they march back in. Rosie's like, Mr. Wells, and he's just like, well, Rosie, get your husband. And she goes and gets the stapler, because we knew it was going to be the stapler, because how could it not be the fucking stapler? And they're going to stop Humphrey's plan, which is they've taken all these fine print forms that everyone's clicked and accepted and all this other shit that they haven't read, and they're going to take it to the Bank of the Dead, I guess, is what it's called.
They're going to take his, because he has in his pocket the contract that Humphrey signed all those years ago, because he signed it because he knew he was such an evil little boy that he had to make sure he had insurance, even though he didn't fucking cash that shit so that he would have actual control over his son. Confusing choice, but he has to deposit it to the Bank of the Dead so that he can have sole control over Walls.
But yeah, so then they start sneaking down. They're trying to get the jump on the goblins, which are all just going through the doorway. And that's when Humphrey shows up and he's just like, "Father!" Shoots a fireball at him. And they start doing some fucking fireball shooting. Christoph won. He's just like, "You guys get the thing in there. Like, do it. Go. Get his soul registered and all that." And so they start trying to sneak it in while he's just fucking having a magic attack on everything. I mean, they're putting it in fucking tubes and shooting it at each other and shit. It's fun. It's dumb. It makes no sense. You're like, why are you guys doing it? Why do you have to shoot fireballs at each other? I don't know.
And then it's the not goblins terrible, but we've seen Harry Potter versions of this that are so big that it just kind of feels discount. It's not terrible, but it is kind of underwhelming when this is our climax.
I mean, it just feels goofy. It feels like
they're
just showing it to have fun in a way is what I took it, because like the real thing is, you know, Paul and Sophie trying to get the soul in, and the goblins like jumping them, and they're still really, I love that they're not just like, "I'm a fucking hero now." They're still just like, "These goblins are really fucking scary." They look grotesque. I'm worried they're going to eat me. I don't want them to touch me. And like, he stops his whole mission. He's just like, I gotta save her from that goblin, cause I'm worried that the goblin's gonna fucking eat her toes. And that's going to ruin our dates for sure, her not having toes. Christoph, too, gets a jump on Dad, starts, you know, fucking Palpatine lightning him.
Right.
He's just like, "Give me that fucking soul, Paul. Give me my soul.
I'm not doing the cute magic anymore. Now I'm doing the Star Wars magic on you."
Yeah, and this doesn't really do anything other than keep you on the ground, apparently. So just be aware, does nothing else. They are not really in a lot of pain.
Well, he could kill Sophie with it. I don't know whether he can't kill his dad because he's, like, too much of a wizard.
And then, then he starts zapping Sophie. Sophie, who's put out a distress call to the other wizards, I guess, they show up and they're just like, "John, you're back. Humphrey, you're evil. What the fuck is going on?" And I'm like, didn't you guys already kind of know? Like, they kind of shit the bed on that. Like, for sure. Like, they just show up like, "Oh my god, there's a plot going on without us."
Also, only one other character has tortured one of the main characters so far, and he's supposed to be one of the, like, "What? You're evil?" Like, all these characters have been acting equally dickish, so it was kind of weird when it's like, we're supposed to like them now. Like, these are the good guys on the rescue.
And that's the thing, is like, I kind of almost would have preferred it to be more ambiguous of that, of like, where it's just like, are they though? Like,
they're all power hungry, would be fun.
Yeah, they're a little, you know, evil too. We're kind of like in Harry Potter, where it's like, you know, there's really only one good witch, you know? And everyone else is kind of like, you're questionable.
Oh, it would have been fun if it was like, "Oh, you're evil? I'm so surprised. Like, you shouldn't be doing that." And it's very clear, like, they were all kind of in on it.
Yeah, well, or it's just more of like, man, he beat me. Like, I want
to beat me to it. Yeah. I should have come up with something that good.
And like, you should just be looking at the future rogues gallery of like, that's our next one and that's our next one, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, instead, so we're having this standoff. Paul's not doing anything. Sophie talks to him. She said, "What if you didn't find that door? What if you made that door?" And so then he makes all the doors ever. And I was like, "Dude, we only need one door." And he's just like, "Give me the doors for the tube." And I was like, "What the fuck?" And none of them can see it. And so he just falls to the floor. And I was just like, well, I guess Paul's dead.
Oh, they couldn't see it? I was confused by that. The non-reaction.
Yeah, because they just go, "Oh my god, he just disappeared. Okay, I guess they couldn't see the fucking door. That's weird. Just made a bunch of doors." And then he goes into the very great visual, probably stolen something out of a Kubrick film, it looks like. Of like just this lighted tunnel way, and then like a Beetlejuice type reception office.
Right.
And I guess like goblins work in hell too or something. I was just like, what the fuck? She got weird fingers as well. And he's like, "I'd like to make a deposit." And then she has like just 100 million stamps, and I love
I
that.
I like that visual, yeah.
So, and cause I loved that they just, she's just like, and it is this one, but also all this right. one. And I was just like, yeah.
And it gave you, like, something I wish there was more in this movie is this idea, like, this may not even necessarily be literal. You're seeing yeah. what a human brain has to make this situation look like.
Makes sense, yeah.
But all of these are like just representatives of symbols. Like, this is what stamps look like to people. And I wish it had more of that sense of ambiguity where it's like, I don't know how much reality I'm really seeing and how much of it's like this fuzzy space.
And then so he decided he proposes a trade instead, which are like, yeah, duh, Paul, that's what you were here for the whole fucking time. Fuck this kid's soul. And then he deposits it. He comes back through another door, and he's just like, I'm back. I did it. Papa Christoph is just like, you're a bad kid. Go to your room. Go to the eternal room of doors, okay? Go there. And then he morphs into his childlike clothing, and he starts whimpering and crying like a child. And he's just like, Papa. He's just like, and this is why I think he never deposited it, because he almost lets him come back. Like, it seems yeah. like he's going to be like, okay, all right, you're right, too far, you're my son. You know, and they're like, no, dude, you've been too soft on this motherfucker for too long. And he's like, no, go. Go into the door.
He could have had control over him and not sent him to yeah. door hell. But
he did have control over him. So it's just like, what the fuck? Or maybe he really just.
No, he didn't. He needed to deposit it.
That control.
Yeah. Like, it was a threat of control. Like, don't make yeah. me have to literally. Maybe it was like giving him a second chance. I wish that was like explained to that. So like, you can still make good choices.
Yeah.
Please make them so I don't have to banish you to eternal door hell.
Well, maybe he did that when he was 13. He was like,
hey, it's like military college.
Okay? Yeah. Remember when I made you write down your soul in that paper? Okay. Well, I'm going to give you another chance. Okay. But I really don't want to have to keep bringing up your soul in the paper thing. Okay.
And I wish Christoph Waltz's character, I wish Humphreys was more evil so I could feel satisfied by this. But I actually felt a little bad for him. I was like,
Yeah,
dude, you're making me feel bad for your character.
I kind of like that enough. Because it's like, yeah. you know, how much was that out of anger of, you know, like he was just told he was an evil child, you know,
yeah,
was
yeah.
he, did, you know, yes, his plan was evil, but it was also stupid. So it's just like,
and also the characters are already doing something that is like morally ambiguous. We have a torturer. We have an actual foot bending, teeth falling outy torturer who's one of our good guys going like, yeah, get that dude. Fuck him. He was mean to me at the Christmas party.
He was. I invaded his dreams and he told me to leave. That was rude.
And he had the power to kick me out.
And then just okay.
Important detail. Important detail because this is very important for how I reacted to the end of the movie. Yep. The two leads kiss.
The two leads kiss? What do you mean?
The leads kiss. The boy and the girl kiss in this scene, which bothers me for what immediately follows it.
But you're forgetting, see, what I thought you were actually going to bring up was that we learned that Dennis's parents are Rosie and the Stapler, and they kiss. And the worst bit of fucking Sam Neill's acting, he goes, Mother! Father! No!
No!
Like, he was just like, I can't see my parents kiss. I'm like, you're like a million-year-old goblin, dude. Like,
but that's the kids,
get over it.
That's the kids' DNA kind of, like, sliding back in, because they'll have characters react. Like, the goblins are very juvenile. Dumb. I mean, when Rosie turns back and she's got, like, a little glitzy, she looks like a Jersey Shore mom kind of thing going on. And it's like, it's very kid logic of, like, what a goblin mom looks like. But it is very funny that Sam Neill's like so much older than this actress, and she's playing like his. Well, now the shirt tucking in joke pays off because it's like, she's the mom, like, so she's ragging on him for his appearance.
He was avoiding his father, who he was in trouble with, because he probably is the reason that he got him turned into a stapler. And then we're doing like a fucking recap eval of the movie. John Wells Sr. is laying out their new roles in the company.
Two jobs to Gryffindor.
Seriously. What's his bucket? Paul is put in charge of Lost and Found because he's good at finding things, everyone. He just created portable doors. let's put him in charge of Lost and Found, and he's not very happy about this. And then Sophie starts reading his thoughts, and then the one thing that is not good with this movie is Patrick Gibson playing Paul Carpenter talking too much, and then we're ending on Patrick Gibson talking too much, and I didn't like this part, but he's just like, are you reading my thoughts? And then they're like, Sophie, are you good with that? And he's like, how do you feel about me? And she's like, yes, I do. And
And this would have worked as a beat had the characters not kissed at the end of the last climax scene. You're having your characters finally together in love at the end of the movie, and it's a question, will they, won't they? They already kissed. They've already will-they'd. So what is this?
I mean, they hold hands under the table, which I thought was sweeter, you know? I mean, the goblins kiss too. So, you know, it was in the air, you know? I'm sure there's a lot more.
It's just weird. You're paying off your romance after you already had the bigger payoff. This scene would have been super cute and a great way to end the movie had they not already had them face consummate a moment ago. Like, it's strange.
Honestly, I forgot they kissed because of this scene. So, and that's cue the credits. But did you stay for after the credits?
Oh, I didn't know there was an after the credits. I turned the credits off because the end credit music was the music from the Comedy of Errors opening where he's breaking things, which is super annoying because it's like chanting like, oh, 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 but it'll keep pausing to do the comedy beats. So you're watching the end credits and it's like, oh, and then they'll have these long gaps. And it's like, we're not seeing the visual joke. Was this the thing the composer is the most proud of? Why did they choose this? This sucks.
They were like, we had access to it.
We forgot we didn't write a theme to this movie.
I actually just hit the button that said skip credits. And then I skipped all the credits and just went to the part where it was just like, Australia gave a lot of money to this movie. And I'm like, mm-hmm. Yeah, they did.
So what's the post credit?
The post credit is he is sitting in Lost and Found, and you'd probably actually like it because it's a different craft room full of different crafts. And he's sitting there bored out of his mind, kind of doing a Tannerism where he's like looking at something for too long because of his boredom. And then a phone rings and he answers the phone on his desk. Of course, it's not that phone because that one's not even fucking plugged in. And then he starts going around the room and trying to find what phone's ringing. He's just answering different phones. And then finally he finds the phone that's ringing. He's like, hello? And then boom, end of movie. And I was like, okay.
Oh, we forgot too. There's a weird other like stinger because the two characters getting together is actually not the final moment. They do a weird joke. So like, they took the door that Humphreys is locked behind.
Oh, right.
And they rip the tag off and say, this door will never work again. I'm emphasizing this towel that you are looking at here will never work again, ever. And then they take it outside and they throw it in the White Queen cleaning thing that's been there the whole time. Weird payoff for that. And then later we see someone at like a hotel, like a cleaning lady. She picks up a towel, goes to the door because you have to say knock knock to turn on the portable door. And she says, housekeeping, knock knock, cut to black. The joke being like, oh, she has the portable door now. Except it doesn't fucking work. You established that this doesn't fucking work. This joke is pointless. I don't understand why they don't follow their own rules for major moments like the last main shot of your movie.
Well, I mean, like they could also just be like, does it work? I don't know. Maybe they're trying to go for an Inception ending of like, does it work? Doesn't it not?
And Humphreys busts out and kills the cleaning lady.
He's just like, I'm a great wizard! Coincidences are bullshit! Okay, Humphreys, just get back in the fucking, get out of here. Just get out of here. Of course, talking about it makes me like parts of it less, for sure, but overall, I enjoyed it. I had fun with it. It was a fun little romp of a movie. Like I said, it gave me a lot of nostalgic feelings. And definitely there's parts where I wish were played up more or handled differently or explained more. But I think that's the curse of all, like, oh, we're taking this one book and making it into one movie. What makes it, what doesn't type of thing. And it's never enough. It's never going to be the right stuff, I guess, is the best way to put it, because there's just too much stuff. And that's what makes books different and enjoyable. Really, any book should be cut up into three movies. But then is anyone going to fucking watch that? Hollywood's not going to take a chance on that. They're like, I really can't commit to making three fucking movies to this one fucking book if the fucking first one tanks or something, you know?
I think it's that this movie is also 2 hours long. And if this movie was cut down to an hour and a half, I think I'd be a lot less upset. So much of the jokes are the stammering, awkward stuff that I've seen a million times before. Like the two really, really long interactions between Sophie and our lead could be like cut in half, and you're like saving like minutes worth of screen time. I think it's just there's so much fat, and then all the little details of the world, which should be what makes a movie overstuffed, are completely absent. So all you're kind of left with is the bones of a movie that I've seen very many times, done much more charmingly. Because this is a movie that really leans on, are you going to find this charming? Because it's not smart. But if it's charming, then you can kind of let the smart kind of slide. Because whimsy isn't usually smart. Whimsy doesn't run on brains.
Yeah. And I really think you could have probably either toned down all the Sophie doing her own job shit.
Yeah.
And like they used the same dog and the same scarf that the dog stole from Paul. I was just like, how the fuck did that? I'm so confused. Is the dog in on it? Like, someone tell me, is that dog in on it? Is he a goblin?
Why didn't the dog steal the towel? Like, he's already stealing cloth objects, so that you have a great tool. You have Chekhov's dog not performing a payoff action. There's so much that feels like it's setting up for something you would expect from a movie like this, and then just kind of like limp wrist it. It's very strange. But it wasn't the most painful thing I've ever watched. I just, when I lost patience with it, like the charm kind of drained out for me. And there, for a Jim Henson project, like the goblins don't look cool. Like, for how much they're built up, for how long we're seeing the little goblin hands, I just wanted like something that felt a little better than like a subpar Haunted Mansion costume.
Like a Toxic Avenger. I got Toxic Avenger vibes. I was like, it's kind of like Toxic Avenger. But I mean, I kind of like that they were just kind of ugly and dumpy, you know? I was just like, I don't think you should be like, oh, fuck yeah, goblins, you know? You should be like, yeah, that's fucking gross and I don't want it to touch me, you know? Like, I stand by that. Like, he had every right to stop what he was doing, but no, don't touch her. You touch that foot can never touch me in bed, ever. It touches me, I'm going to get up, I'm going to take a shower, I'm going to get another bed, okay? That's what's going to happen, because I'm always going to think about her fucking goblin toes, all right?
I don't know where they've been. They've been all over the world. What have they been doing? They've been sticking their hands in everybody's stuff.
Your hands are always slimy. Every scene I saw, you had slimy hands, you little fuckers. And you're not even that little. You're pretty fucking big. Why are you big fucking goblins? I don't like this. Sam Neill's fucking, his goblin one was a little too fleshy. I was just like, why can't we want him to still be recognizable? I don't think anyone's going to be like, oh, I've heard this man's voice and I forgot what his face looked like. But I was like, why is he a little more fleshy and the rest are a little more green? This is kind of grosser somehow.
I just love that they paid off how weird his body like mannerisms were in the rest of the movie. Because he started doing like this weird like hunch where he was like kind of flapping his arms about in scenes where he's like wearing the suit and he looks like a human. And I was like, what is this thing that he's doing? And then it's like,
well, it makes sense why he had the thing upside down in his hand and couldn't really make it work. You know, it's just because he's got big fucking goblin fingers. He's just like, I don't know, man. I mean, fuck. It's all just a projection in your mind, dude. I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's just, again, though, like, Jim Henson is what it is. And, like, they can't make everything look like Dark Crystal because then you're just like, that's a Dark Crystal, boo! So,
yeah.
You know, it's probably got to be the roughest thing in the world living in your father's shadow, trying to create shit and just being constantly told, like, that sucks.
Being told,
thanks.
It's like, I have a dream. It's to make the Happy Time Murders, and everybody will forgive me for not being my dad after this. Get me Melissa McCarthy and Joel McHale.
Is she going to be funny Melissa McCarthy in it? No, God, no.
What is that? I've never heard of it.
The 15 minutes you sent bridesmaids.
And well, I have not gone back. I'm terrified. I've got this little gem in my mind of like, there was a funny Melissa McCarthy once. I don't want to ruin it by going back and rewatching Bridesmaids and finding out, Oh, this was never good.
No, it wasn't. Watch Spy again, if anything. That's.
I never saw it. I heard
oh
it was.
Oh my god, it's the most unwatchable shit I've ever seen. No, oh. Painful.
Okay.
It's like a 2-hour movie that feels like the rest of your life. Like somewhere, I'm still watching it, you know? I never came out of that room.
You're in a room full of doors watching Spy endlessly.
What the fuck? Someone made this movie? Someone gave it money? That is, Portable Door.
That was a movie that we letst.
If you like this episode, you can listen to other episodes, and you can follow us on social media. Just look for Let's Movie. And otherwise, just we'll be back in 2 weeks with another movie that probably maybe sucked or didn't. We'll see. Justin, take us away.
We do what we can.